Welcome to the ID10T podcast number 1,100 episodes. If you go to ID10T.com, sign up for our email list so that we can let you know about when we put up our new vintage. I mean, they're vintage. They're old, new things. They're old, but new to the site. They're vintage items that are new to us and new to you. So we have a bunch of Halloween stuff that we just put up and a bunch of Chucky Child's Play stuff, like some Chucky socks and some hats and stuff like that too. So go check it out. And vintage actually plays very well into the podcast today, but I'll get to that in a second. Let's talk about you, the ID10T community. Events at ID10T.com. Like this person, Eddie, who said, "Hi, my name is Eddie. I work for an AZA-accredited zoo, that means one of the good ones, in El Paso, Texas. Several years ago, we discovered our Asian elephant, Juno, has breast cancer. She's been treated 5 times now with an experimental treatment called electrochemotherapy to much success. A documentary was even made on this and aired on National Geographic. Her treatments are being used to develop new techniques to help combat cancer in humans, too. Unfortunately, like most places, our facility is in need financially due to COVID, which is why I convinced a zookeeper group I'm a part of to let me design a t-shirt with Juno's footprint as part of a campaign with all proceeds going to help eat a small chunk of what it takes to properly give an elephant the love and care they deserve. If you could share this, it would mean the world to me, her caretakers, and of course, Juno, the Asian elephant. Please help us help Juno as she continues to stomp out cancer." This site is bonfire.com/JunoStrong. J-U-N-O, strong. Oh, thank you so much, Eddie, for sharing that. And hope you're hanging in there. Hope Juno is hanging in there. If you'd like to share your thing on the ID10T community corkboard, you can email us events@ID10T.com. This episode is Elizabeth and Ethan Finkelstein, who started a website that I adore called CircaOldHouses.com. And Circa Old Houses is basically a listing site for architectural gems that are for sale around the country. And I've been going to it for years. I would just go and kind of just daydream and, you know, just gawk and marvel at amazing details in architecture. You know, the way when they did things in the old days with houses, and not like the glass boxes that get thrown up today in a minute and a half. And I'm being an old person. But they then started the wildly successful offshoot on Instagram called Cheap Old Houses. So they started the Cheap Old Houses Instagram feed, which itself has a bunch of little offshoots too. I think there's like 1.5 million people following that Instagram feed. But it's an incredible collection of really affordable architectural gems that do need a bit of work, but if you're up for the challenge, and who knows, maybe in the last 7 months, if you've just decided you need a change or realize, like, you know what, I do all my work on the internet now, I don't have to live in the city that I'm in, I want to start over somewhere else, and you're up for the challenge of doing a bit of work to a house, then Cheap Old Houses is an incredible feed. The pictures are great. There's a lot of really great interior photos as well. And whether you're looking to just scroll through and daydream, or if you really are looking for, you know, for yourself, for a change, then it's a phenomenal feed. Elizabeth has such an incredible eye, and everything that she posts on any of the feeds and Circa Old Houses, they all just have an extra special something to them. So I highly, highly, highly recommend it. Again, the homes on Cheap Old Houses, I believe they're under 100,000, all the houses on there, but they do need a lot of work and some love. But if you're like Elizabeth and Ethan, or you're like Lydia and I, and you see a house that might be run down, but it has really gorgeous bones or really special elements or a really amazing history, and you feel like, you know what, I see the magic in this, I see the beauty in it, I need to save this house, I can restore it, I can bring it back to its former glory and preserve it, then it's definitely a feed for you. It's at Cheap Old Houses again on Instagram, and then there's a bunch of offshoots of it as well, and CircaOldHouses.com. So I just had such a wonderful time talking to Elizabeth and Ethan and just sort of like nerding out about house restoration and preservation. So I just want to thank them so much for their time and also for what they do to preserve and help promote restoration of, you know, architectural history. And even if you're not into those things, there's so many wonderful lessons in this podcast about starting a thing that you're passionate about, getting it up and running, scaling it up, having realistic expectations, and kind of designing the type of thing that you want to do around the kind of life you want to have. So there's plenty of stuff in here, even if you're not addicted to house restoration sites. Here's the ID10T podcast number 1100 with Elizabeth and Ethan Finkelstein as we roll the thing.
Initiating ID10T protocol.
Remember the first time I discovered Circle Old Houses, but it was years ago, and because my wife and I are amateur house restorers, and we live in a historic home, and we've restored other homes, and when I discovered your site, it was like, holy shit, this is the thing that I've been waiting for, a website that calls all of this stuff together. If we were in the same room, you would get a standing ovation for creating such an incredible site. And I've recommended it to many people, but it's also just the eye for design too. Like almost every site on that house is like, fuck, I'd live here. Shit, I'd live here too. Oh my God. Where's Congers, New York? I don't know, but
hey, that's next to us.
Congers, New York is literally like right the town over from us if you want to know.
Well, you have a real sweet like 18th century federal style house on like 13 acres there in Congers for like $1.8 million, which is, if you live in Los Angeles, $1.8 million is actually not a super, like that's a pretty average home price here.
Yes.
Totally.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah. It's so funny. Like the show Million Dollar Listing. I'm like, $1 million will get you nothing anymore. Like they need to change that to like $28 million listing. Like that's kind of like a normal threshold now. It's so funny.
Yeah, you're absolutely right, because the median house price in LA must be $700,000 or $800,000, or it might be creeping up to $1 million. So you're absolutely right. That's if it just took place in LA, they could just call it like median price house show.
Right, right.
I would love to get a sense of where y'all came from, where the idea came from, because I know you have backgrounds in architecture and preservation, architecture history. So can you just walk me through the journey of the inception of Circa Old Houses and the wheres and the whens and the hows?
Yeah, well, it's kind of, Circa really is like the meeting of our minds. Ethan runs a digital design and marketing agency. And I'm just an all old things nerd. Like we both have old houses in our lives. His grandmother had a 200 acre farm in New Hampshire.
And it was actually going up for sale, like kind of when we first met. And, you know, it was a 200 acre farm. It was going for 600,000. It was a federal style in the 1700s. It was built. And I, you know, I think we were dating for a few weeks and it was kind of like, hey, Elizabeth, you want to like move to this farm with me on the middle of nowhere in New Hampshire?
And I was sort of like, I don't even know you yet. But I was also like, wow, this is like a man of my own heart. Like, cause we're going to do that someday. And it's so funny how we're always like, to us, it's like, we're going to get that old farmhouse someday. We just are constantly sort of talking about.
So it's, yeah, I think it's been this epic dream and journey to fulfilling that. And, you know, we had a kid along the way and, you know, I've been married for many ish years and, you know, have been just trying to chip away at it slowly, and this has been one of the brainchilds to kind of get there.
We really wanted to make old houses cool because like, I have a master's in historic preservation. I've gone through sort of like the traditional world of preservation and testified at all the like community board hearings and the Landmarks Commission hearings and done all the kind of academic stuff. And, you know, I'm like, why is the median age person at these meetings like so much older than me? I would be asked to be on every single board of an old house all the time because they wanted to like, they wanted young people to join. So they would ask me, but I was like the only one. And I was like, why? Young people love cool old things. I know they do because they're like spinning vinyl records and they're wearing vintage clothes and like
posting on Instagram with filters.
Yeah. I'm like, this is like, what is the preservation world missing? So we were like, let's just start a site to make old houses cool because my parents were trying to sell their house and wanted to market it. You know, it was going to take a specific buyer who wanted an old house. And
every realtor who kind of came in was like, oh, it's four bedrooms and two baths and this and that. And they saw nothing of the 1700s character, of the huge fireplace, of the like warmth that you feel on a Christmas morning or, you know, any holiday for that matter.
We're like real nostalgics over here.
No, listen, honestly, I can't spin my desktop computer, but you can see like, what's on the other side of my computer on my wall right now, what I'm looking at is this very old style wallpaper, which you can see. And every portrait in here is a Victorian oil portraiture.
So awesome.
I have a whole wall and they're just random oil portraits that I picked up at flea markets and secondhand stores. And, you know, when I travel and do stand up, I go kind of see what the local vintage scene, antique scene is. And so I'll just grab like something from an antique mall and throw it in my suitcase. And so it.
Do you like going to auctions? Antique auctions?
Yeah. I mean, there are a couple of good auction sites that that I've actually been stingy about not mentioning on the podcast. I'm like, I don't want the word to get out. But, you know, almost everything in our house is old. It's like, it's vintage, it's antique, you know, stuff we brought back from, we have a big armoire we had shipped back from Austria that we found in Salzburg. Like everything has a story, and I see it all as that we're curators of these things at this moment in time, and hopefully we'll then pass them down. But our house looks like a freaking natural history museum. Like, it looks like a vintage store. And I'm looking in your background and I see like a really cool old cabinet in the background and some really great warm wallpaper. It's real nice.
This cabinet in the,
this. Well, sorry, guys.
Well, this cabinet in the back, like I was at this antique shop with my mom and it's like, it was handmade by someone in like probably 1800 ish. And it was passed down in the family and the great grandmother was passing away and none of the kids wanted it. So it ended up, this woman bought it and was selling it as an antique. And I'm like, I'll take it and I'll write her a letter and tell her that I wanted it. Cause I'm like, how can you?
Cause her whole family didn't want it. Yeah.
Yeah, no one in the family wanted it. And I'm like, well, it's, you know, it just, yeah, I know. I
go get IKEA. No offense to IKEA, but you know. No.
Wanting anything that doesn't have a story. I mean, that's like the fun of things. And why have anything if you don't? But going back to what Ethan said about auctions, if you haven't run the country auction circuit, it's hilarious. Like the people, the food they serve, it is a whole subculture unto itself. Like I remember when we were there and these two guys behind us were like these like two like big burly biker dudes. Harley and they dudes. Were yeah, they were like bidding and they ended up bidding on this like little violet demitasse like teacup that they won. And there's just people, you know, like you get to know the people and what they're there for. And everybody's like a little bit crazy in their own way after like these crazy niche things they sort of love. So it's a very, very funny world. It's a whole, like probably if I had nothing else to do every Saturday night, I would go to an auction because it's just so funny.
Wait, is that for their own personal use or is it dealers that are buying stuff to then sell?
I think it depends which auction house you go to.
Yep.
There are some that are definitely more higher end auctions that get dealers. But I grew up kind of way upstate New York that doesn't, it's far enough away from the city that it doesn't really attract those people. So it's much more like country auctions and people, there are definitely some people who are looking to resell, but a lot of people who just like want to collect.
Well, it's crazy that idea that you know that someone had to craft the thing by hand. And it's also just like the subtle imperfections where you know, like, it was not made by a machine and it's aged because of however it was used, like certain parts of it may wear if people's hands were opening one. It's like everything about it, it's just that this living three-dimensional diary of a bunch of stories that we probably will never know, you know, there's right. No way to know, but you know that they're imbued in the pieces just by nature of the fact that they have survived for, you know, one or two centuries. What's the oldest piece of furniture that you have?
I think a lot of our stuff, we love primitive, sort of federal style furniture.
Yeah, like things that were really handcrafted. I don't know. I split my love for like really handcrafted stuff and really like kitschy mid-century stuff. So
I would say 1700s.
Yeah, though. We have some stuff from like the 1700s because a lot of the auction houses near us, you know, my parents live way upstate New York, which is right on the border of Vermont. So you get a lot of like really early American houses that are selling their stuff. You know, whenever anyone passes away, the family sends everything to the auction house. And it's usually just because the houses were very, very old up there. And that's kind of the style that you get a lot of very early stuff. A lot of Shaker things are in auction houses up there.
And honestly, it's fun to be into something that is not super expensive. So being into primitives right now is like the easiest thing. If you're into mid-century modern, you're spending tons of money on, you know, so right, it's like almost anything. Like niching within the niche to kind of find out, you know.
If you know where to go though, because I feel like, you know, the word is out on salvage and upcycle and vintage. And so, you know, there are sites out there that have gone up, it feels like 10 to 20% a year, and probably because some of these aggregator sites take a big chunk, and so the dealers are having to hike prices on things. But, you know, there are things now that I feel like were a few hundred dollars maybe 5 or 7 years ago, and now are like $1,800, $3,000. Yes. It's like, fuck, just wait a minute. This is a great cabinet, but is it, you know, I don't know if it should be $4,800. And so I think part of it is, I don't know, I guess where I'm going is there going to be a Circa Old Furniture offshoot at some point?
Well, are you familiar with Cheap Old Houses, our Instagram feed?
Yes, I follow Cheap Old Houses. Like I follow Cheap Old Houses, Historical Homes of America. There's like three or four that I follow that, yes. And Cheap Old Houses is such a stroke of genius because Circa's great if you can spend, you know, $500,000 up to, you know, $3 or $4 million. But Cheap Old Houses is such a brilliant idea because it really, I feel like this audience you were talking about, the younger people who might like this kind of, just didn't know where to go to find these things. So it's like, I don't know where to go to find this type of thing. So you're basically spoon feeding that for, you know, houses for less than, for $100,000 or less. And they're all just amazing. And now it's like, I think we're proving in the last 6 months, it almost kind of doesn't matter where you live. If you know, it's like most of our work we're doing via Zoom. So have you noticed an uptick in the last 6 months in traffic and interest and activity?
Yeah. We typically average on Cheap Old Houses like 10,000 new followers weekly.
Oh my gosh.
Which is amazing. But since the pandemic, it's been like 20 to 25 new followers weekly. People, you know, this whole thing about that realtors say, like location, 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 that's always been the mantra of real estate agents. And it's so different now. Location, it has such a different meaning for people. It doesn't have to be tied to your work anymore. So it opens up the possibilities for so many more, you know, so many more opportunities.
Yeah. I mean, I think also the media has kind of caught on, as well as just like the word, you know, everyone was, it was so weird in the middle of the pandemic or the very intense period. You know, I think it was like, you know, and we knew we had to be like working extra hard because like this content was the only positive news almost that anyone was receiving on their Instagram feed. Like people were just dreaming and their minds were exploding as to, because they were stuck in these cities or in these apartments or wherever they were. I don't know, just freaking out. And then seeing a plot of land on 5 acres for $60,000, you're like, what?
Yeah.
It's so
aspirational and it's so transformed. It's so, yeah, I mean, we look at properties all the time. And I don't think we're going to, it's not that we're going to, you know, move to Congress, New York, but I showed my wife that 18th century federal property. And she was like, oh my God, that's gorgeous. And, you know,
come be our neighbors.
Yeah.
I mean, if, you know, if it weren't for the winters, I guess, cause my wife's from Connecticut and we really do like where we live, but boy, so, you know, like more and more, we're just like a ranch property somewhere, you know, we'll put some friggin' bees on there and get a couple goats, you know, and as long as we have good internet so we can work from there, it does, like, what else? We don't really, we'd be okay. So I get it. I really do. I look at your site just to daydream, and I'm sure that's part of it for most people.
Yeah. Well, I think the houses on Sheepfold Houses are particularly interesting, not necessarily just because of their prices, but a lot of them need a lot of work because they've been either neglected for a long time, or they're in places that haven't had the kind of investment that, you know, where you live or where we live. So where we live, right outside of New York City, every time a house gets sold, the kitchen gets renovated, the bathroom gets renovated, and then new people move in and they redo all that. And it's like, it's constantly flipped over and over. So
every 10 years is the latest trend of, you know, this kind of tile or whatever. Yeah.
Exactly.
Oh, yeah. Oh God. Yeah. Yeah. And I just get so, you know, whenever I see like pink granite countertops, I just want to scratch my eyes out, you know, it's like, well, that was the trend 15, 20 years ago. And now I feel like it's, you know, the open concept and the, right. You know, fake marble. I don't know.
Well, trends move so much more quickly now than they did back then. I mean, Greek Revival as a style and was popular for like a million years. If that existed today, it would be like 1 year and then the whole next thing we'd be onto it. So if you update your kitchen this year, it's going to look bad by next year. If you don't work with the style of your house and make it look correct to what the house is, it's never going to look wrong if you work with a house. And what's cool about the houses on Sheepfold Houses is because they haven't been flipped so many times, they're kind of like these amazing little time capsules. And I think that's what makes them so fascinating, because you can like, it's the only sort of consistent feed where you're constantly going to see like an original Tudor kitchen. And it's so fun to see things in their original condition like that. Even if the paint's peeling and they've been neglected, just seeing them kind of untouched and unchanged is really amazing.
Yeah, some of the craziest properties are the ones that are like these crazy pink kitchens, or where they're so in this capsule of time that no one, like basically people rip them out every single time they see them. And the mantra has been just get rid of this stuff. This is so gaudy.
It's dated or whatever.
And now it's like, you don't, there's such a needle in a haystack to find some of that stuff. And it just, people go wild for that period because it doesn't even exist in time.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's also having the right, I think it's also having someone with the right eye to say like, well, instead of completely, because there are certain things, you know, if your house is old and has never really been updated, there are certain things that made sense 100 years ago that don't. It's like now people have more clothes than they had 100 years ago.
Totally.
You know, now people are a little bit taller. Like there's more space. Like people need more space. There's more kitchen stuff. We have TVs. We have, you know, computers and things. And so what elements can you preserve? Like how can you preserve the maximum amount of elements to still keep it in that period, but then expand it in a way that's useful to now? And I feel like not everyone, some people just kind of go with that all or nothing, like just rip all this shit out and just put in the, you know, just make it cheap and easy. And now we briefly pause to thank our sponsor for this episode of the ID10T podcast, ExpressVPN. So perhaps you've heard of the term surveillance capitalism, but it basically just means that big tech companies can monitor what you're doing online, mine your data, and then target ads back at you by monitoring things like searches, messages, video histories. But when you run ExpressVPN on your device, it hides your IP address, which makes it much more difficult for them to do those things, to sell your data. data to advertisers. ExpressVPN also encrypts 100% of your internet data to keep you safe from hackers and prying eyes. Many VPNs slow down your internet, but ExpressVPN is incredibly fast and easy to use. Just tap one button and you are protected. So, if you don't like the idea of tech companies exploiting your personal information, then visit expressvpn.com/ID10T right now, and you can get 3 extra months free of ExpressVPN. That is ExpressVPN, ExpressVPN.com/ID10T. Protect your data. Go to ExpressVPN.com/ID10T to learn more. Thank you to ExpressVPN for sponsoring this episode of the ID10T podcast, which we now return to. To hear some tips that you might have for people who say, like, look, you know, I bought a house for not a lot of money. I do have to completely change the kitchen. What is a way that I can preserve as much as I can and still make it livable by today's standards?
I would say for the kitchen, as an example, I mean, you know, if it's a farmhouse, you know, you go, like, you know, get very simple. You don't need to do, you know, your granite, you don't need to have all this great cabinetry, all this, you know, you need to have storage, you need to have a pantry, you need to have some of those functional items, but, you know, you don't need to, like, make it open concept with a, I don't know, an island and totally disrupt the sort of flow that was intentional. Elizabeth has probably way more to talk about.
Yeah, I'm a little obsessed with kitchens. I think, even though I hate cooking, which is so funny, but I want a kitchen that looks really good. I think that, you know, it doesn't take much to do a quick search. We have so much access to everything online now, and in histories and design. There have been articles written on the history of kitchen design, and you don't have to intensely research this to get a basic understanding of the kind of thing you should look for in a kitchen. So it wasn't until like the 40s-ish that the idea of like a built-in kitchen was a thing. Before that, kitchens were sort of like cobbled together pieces of furniture. So you had things like Hoosier cabinets, which was like an all-in-one kind of cabinet that kind of did various things for you and was storage. So you would place that there, and then you'd have the standalone sink, and then you'd have the standalone icebox or fridge. And then as it kind of moved on, we got more into this idea of like built-in kind of cabinetry. So just knowing when your house was built and understanding a little bit about the era, just understanding sort of colors that were popular at the time. You know, I'm not a purist. I'm not saying you have to. I probably would restore my house exactly as it was at the time, but I know not everybody's that crazy.
Right, just like we're changing our oven to be a 1940s oven because we live in a 1940s house.
Like, yeah, like I bought like a restored 1940s oven. Now that's a little bit extreme, and I'm probably going to burn the house down.
It's being completely restored. It's not like a, you know, a hack job to get this oven.
Right, right.
But it will be at 10,000 pounds, and I'll have to get it in the house.
And we actually learned that the oven we're getting is like, you know, our house is from the 40s, and it's kind of small, and the little like doorways in it are really narrow, and it's actually like the doorways going into the kitchen are 2 inches smaller than the oven. Oh. So I already ordered it, and I'm like, I don't know. This is so typical. I have no idea what we're going to do, but it's going to be totally worth it when the oven.
I think what you're going to do is you're going to have to pull a door jam off, get it through, and then reattach the door jam. And then
Yeah, I mean, anyways, Chris, this is a whole thing.
Ethan's like, oh my gosh, this is so typical.
But it sort of never ends. And I feel like we're constantly in a state of restoration because it's just something that we love to, And it really just feels like a form of expression where you're living in the art. You get to live in it. You know, it's like you get to experience it. Instead of just look at it, it becomes a part of your ecosystem. And to me, that is, it's such a fun thing to do. But of course, you know, there's a million ways. So we have this like little pool house thing, and we're going to kind of turn it into, you know, like a little bit of a music room and a game room. But it was a complete disaster. And we've been trying to find this balance. It's like 5 different styles. All at once. Like we got this burned Japanese yakisugi wood for the outside, but then we everything in it is salvaged. So there are a couple of windows that are from a Tudor place. There's a door that's the bottle glass from an old Spanish place. And we're trying to find the perfect balance of getting all of these. Like we got, because our house is Spanish, so we got barrel tiles for the top, but they're black to go with the yakisugi. And so we're trying to find the perfect balance. Like, can we balance all of these styles together and yep. make them talk to each other so that it doesn't, because there's a real fine line between like a cohesive piece and then just a fucking mess.
It's so true.
Well, there's always eclectic style. You can fit it right in there.
Yeah, it's, I know. Architectural historians are always like, we don't know what style is. It's eclectic. They call it eclectic. You know, I think whatever you're going to do, I always say, just do no harm to the house. Don't throw out your original windows. Don't remove original stuff. Like, if what you're doing is reversible, or it's doing something on top of the house, or, no, granted, if the house was a gut job and there's nothing there to begin with and you have to start from scratch, that's a completely different story. But I just always feel like, you know, the safest bet is to, in case the next person who comes along wants to, you know, have the windows.
Well, this pool house was added in like the 80s or something. So it's not an original piece of anything. So, and it was pretty much falling down. So we had more liberty with it than we would have had if it were in our house, which is a, you know, 1928 Spanish Paul Williams house. So it's like we had a little more freedom with that, but I would love, I'm sure that people now who are starting to realize like, oh, I could afford a house from cheap old houses as long as, you know, I was a little flexible on where I would live. I'd love to talk a little bit about just for what people can expect. It's like, if you're a first-time home buyer, and I don't want to scare anyone away because I love being a homeowner. I think it's great. I recommend it if you can swing it. But some people go, oh my God, $100,000 house. You know, I'll just tackle all the work inside myself. It is that thing, that journey of like, okay, but just know that once you open walls, you don't know what you're going to find. And if you try to do things on the cheap yourself, you'll probably end up spending more down the road than if you just kind of did it right the first time. So can you talk a little bit about that process and also some advice you have for finding good contractors that will show up and actually, like, you know, keep the project on schedule?
Well, the second part, I don't know that I can help you with. I think everybody has the contractor that disappears.
But I do think, actually, if you talk about the contractor specifically, I think in some of these locations, you're not dealing with a New York City or LA audience or people who, you know, I have a buddy who was trying to fix his place in Ditmas Park, Brooklyn. And he had like five people come out for the gutter job and like no one would come. This guy even left a ladder once he finally did come. It was just a whole mess. You know, and the price was just completely exorbitant, and he ended up getting his buddy to just help him. It's totally a real issue, I think, in the urban places. But if you talk about some of these places that these are in, I mean, that is your demographic, if you think about it. I think that is your, you know, you don't have your tech companies, you don't have, you know.
Some sort of rural environments, the industries are more kind of craftsmen, but you know, it's fewer white collar jobs around there and more people that do things like contracting, and know how to help with things like that. And you're dealing with so much less competition and price competition in cities. And I would just say, what's that?
They're more accountable to each other because it's a smaller town.
Totally.
So they're absolutely. And they all
really important.
And totally. They all know each other. So you can find someone who does it and ask, you know, word of mouth and that sort of thing. I think word of mouth recommendation is sort of the kind of best.
And I think getting back to your first point about, you know, I'm just going to do this myself. And, you know, I mean, you know, when I was 20, I swear that I was like, yes, I can do X, Y, and Z. You know, there wasn't even the YouTube that we had, you know, all the stuff, the access points that we have on the internet now that we can look into this stuff. And even now, before I get into a job, and we are not like big contractor people. I mean, you know, we've done some renovations, et cetera, but, and obviously, you know, most of them are historically accurate, but I think I would probably be totally over my head at that point when I was going to buy that farm with Elizabeth, 200, you know, that was a 1700s house, and didn't have the money to actually do anything with it.
But like beautifully naive too. Like a lot of people totally. Who do their first project say, I'm glad I didn't know what I was getting into because I never would have done it. And yet it turned out to be the best thing I ever did. I think of it a lot like parenting. So we have a 5-year-old, and 5 years ago after I had that baby, I was literally like, what did I do to my life? I'm never going to sleep again. This is crazy. And like, who would ever have a second child? Like, who does this? Who ever recommends this? And so, but of course, then you come out of it and you realize it's also the most rewarding thing you'll ever do. And you love your children. And it's kind of like a house, you know. Yes. Is it hard? Yeah. Are some of the greatest things you do in your life hard? You know, right now, Ethan just heard me go on this diatribe the other day about this, but I feel like we build houses now and we implement technologies to make our lives super easy, where we just sit here and we yell at Google to like turn the lights on for us. And we don't work with our hands, and we don't get up and do things. So therefore we have to go to a gym to exercise because we're not moving our bodies. Right. And we're not doing satisfying things with our hands. And those are very, it's
and
human
talk about,
nature
and talk
to
about
to do
the
that.
Mental health kind of component of this, where you're like trying to figure something out. You're trying to do something to, you know, better yourself. You're sitting there on Twitter or whatever, soaking in the political environment or whatever it is, and you're not doing something positive for the world and the community. And you're just kind of sucking in all this, you know, negative energy that the internet kind of breeds.
Unless you're following Circle Houses or Cheap Old Houses,
exactly.
Then it's all positive.
That's
energy.
The breath of fresh air. That's
thank God.
That's the air freshener. If the car, you know, like if the car smells like farts and old Burger King, Circle Old Houses is that gorgeous pine air freshener that just hangs from the mirror and makes everything okay. It just makes it all okay.
But I'm trying to think now. I mean, there's so many different ways. You know, I think the biggest thing is we literally have one of our taglines is like save your pennies, get that $15,000 house. Every single house is going to be a different case. You need to do, you know, you need to work with an inspector. Some of these houses that Elizabeth posts are in amazing condition. They might just have some paint issues and maybe need a new water heater and, you know, have some things that you can live with, you know. We've seen some houses that don't have toilets and a kitchen and anything, and you have to bring all that stuff in, and just the stuff that will go in there, you know, is going to cost you a ton of money for those appliances on top of the wiring, the insulation, you know, all the carpentry, you know, don't even talk about foundational issues. So, you know,
really
do your homework. You can't just buy a house. I mean, you know, I think the media has recently kind of been like, people are buying houses, you know, unseen on Instagram, you know, via Cheap Old Houses.
I don't think anybody is that naive. I think everybody knows they're getting into work and they want that project.
I think, you know, we've had some stories of people like flying across the country or driving across the country to see some of these houses. You should do that if you're actually interested in this. And get an inspector for $300. He'll walk through the place with you. He'll tell you all the issues and he'll give you a quick price quote as to what everything is going to be, you know, add up to, or you can add it up yourself. And then I think
there's something about, sorry, were you gonna, am I cutting you off?
No, okay. I mean,
I think there's something about enjoying the process of it and not feeling like, okay, if you buy a house for under $100,000 and you can afford that and you're not, you know, you either buy it in cash or you have a very small mortgage that's not going to kill you, and you're able to save up a little bit every month to do the work that needs to be done in the house.
You have $500 a month to get a new dishwasher, to get a new whatever, a fridge or whatever.
Right. And then you work on it over time. I think there's this, you know, my uncle said to me a few years ago, he's like, kids today want to start where I ended up. Like, I didn't have my really nice house until I was like, you know, older, and everybody wants that like Instagrammable house within like a month. You know, we're gonna move in and we're gonna like,
that's the HGTV of it all though, where you think, oh, you know, this will be done, you know, this will be done in 6 weeks and it's gonna be like this, you know, showcase style. Like, well, it's not,
and it's gonna cost you $30,000.
Right. It'll cost you.
I know, I see those sometimes, like, what the fuck. Yeah, I talked to this guy named Chase Morrill, who's has this amazing show called Maine Cabin Masters, and they do these renos on these cabins for like $25,000, but they are essentially like camp cabins. It's like they don't, they're amazing inside. They do such amazing work, but it's not like, it's not quite, you know, it's like the budget on a house will be a little bit more. And so that's what, just as long as people expect that. And I think there is a little bit of a Dunning-Kruger thing, which happens, which is that study, which basically said like, you know, people don't know what they don't know, and they will generally assume that they know more because they aren't aware of what they aren't aware of. And so they might go, oh, it's really easy to like fix up a house and I'll just get some YouTube videos. It's like, well, yes, maybe for like patching holes and things, but you really need licensed people to do foundation work, to handle the electrical, to make sure that you're not taking out a support beam. Like, unless you're a structural engineer, be very careful because it can compromise your life and your safety. And you don't want wires going up in walls and blowing up.
And just the amount of time. I mean, we kind of say it's time or money. You can throw money at it or you can, you know, spend time on it. It's going to take you probably 10 times as long to do the thing that a professional is going to take to do. And if you don't want to pay them that money, then you have to sacrifice your time. I mean, I would never, never recommend anything structural or, you know, electrical. So you have a fire or what, you know, oh my God.
I would love to kind of walk through a little bit, going back to the thing about like when you started Circle Old Houses and, you know, just the kind of the meta story of like the passion project. I assume it was a passion project when you started it because you said, oh, I just want to show people that these old houses are cool and I want to aggregate them in a really great way. And obviously you have marketing background and you have architecture history background, but are you also still working Country Living?
Yes. I'm the real estate writer for Country Living.
My wife and I just did a story with them because she started this trend where she puts up I came home a couple years ago and there was a Halloween tree. And I go, what the hell is this? And she goes, oh, I wanted a Halloween tree. We'll roll it into a Thanksgiving tree and then roll it into a Christmas
nice.
Tree.
Nice.
Wanted That's a holiday, amazing.
Holiday tree up for like 3 months out of the year. So we're, you know, in a couple of weeks, we'll put up our Halloween tree. So we just did a thing for Country Living. And so you was it just a side project when you started or did you guys both go, you know what, we really are going to go all in on this. I'm going to kind of push everything else aside. Or did that take a little bit of time? I'd love for people who are thinking about starting their passion project, how much of their lives, how quickly are they willing to let it take over?
Okay. So, well, first of all, you're talking to two people who really firmly believe in the freedom of working for ourselves. And you know, we're big on just like financial independence, on independence of our time. Now, that's not to say that we don't work all the time,
right?
But we can work from anywhere. And
we have the dream of being able to work from anywhere. But
yeah, and I think that, you know, so when we started Circa, we were just sort of looking for, I don't know, you know, we've had a lot of ideas. When I was living in Brooklyn, I just kept starting blogs about this, that, and the other thing. And they were cute and fun, but they were never going to really like be a business for me. And Circa, I'm trying to think like how we came up with the idea of Circa.
It was one of the, I mean, there's so many stories, Chris, and it's like, you know, how dense are people or thick are people in terms of just their complexity. But one of the things was, you know, we really wanted Elizabeth to have a gig. She was working with me in Brooklyn. We were doing my digital marketing agency. And then essentially, you know, she left her full-time job preservation and then she moved on to work with me. And then it was like working together in the same company, especially for something that I kind of created, she needed her own project. So we ended up kind of getting this project. It was Circa. She had the challenges in her life of her parents trying to sell the house. We also wanted something that she could do and we could have a baby. So literally we planned this thing like 4 years before we had a kid. And we're like, okay, how do we make something so you can work from home and not have to stress about not being home with our child that was not born?
It's so funny that that's the way Ethan sees it, because I think that's a huge part of it. But I'm just such an idealist that I'm like, I want to do something that's all saving houses. So like, he probably had that in the back of his mind, but I don't really ever remember having that discussion. Like, this is going to be something that's going to secure your financial freedom. Like, I think this was like, because I don't know.
And how do we use her passions, right? And like, how do we just, like, she has this awesome degree from this awesome, you know, school about historic preservation. And like, for me, it was like, how do you use that and not, you know, I mean, I'm working for people like L'Oreal and Revlon. So it's sort of like, you know.
You like big corporate clients. And I think, you know, the world of preservation is very much, okay, there are preservation architects and there's the whole sort of trades and restoration side of it. But the world I was in was like the nonprofit side of it. And there was, you know, it operates in a very kind of, the traditional world of preservation advocacy operates in a certain way. And it's been operating like that for a very long time. And we kind of wanted to I just wanted to shake it up a little. And I wanted to, again, like we said, like bring it to younger people.
And I think ultimately it started like early on, we kind of knew sort of how many houses we could actually save if we were bringing a national audience to the love of this stuff, more so than ever she could have done in a nonprofit that actually had funds going directly to, you know, something. The core thing was like always, how do we just save all the old houses? And it was, and now like we have 40, 50 stories of people who have bought and rescued these homes. I mean, one of the funny things that I kind of see us as is like, we're like the Sarah McLachlans of old houses, you know, like we're saving these like rescue animals or, you know, these rescue houses.
Oh, like the animal shelter commercial.
You have to play the Sarah McLachlan song over like a bunch of dissolving images of like that are being saved. I mean, go ahead.
I don't know. I mean, it sounds all plotted out, to be fair. I think that I think the only projects that ever really take off are those that totally come from your heart. If you go into anything being like, I'm going to do this to make money, there is so much work that goes into running your own business that you better want to do it every minute of every day. And we love this enough that I will push that content out day after day after day. And it never
And Cheap Old Houses was totally an accident. Basically.
Cheap Old Houses, we never thought would be a business model.
It was just listening.
Crazy.
It was just listening to people from Circa as to what they loved and wanted, and they wanted cheap old houses.
Yeah, like that. Those were the ones that people were. I started this column on Circa called 10 under 50K, where I would post like 10 houses under $50,000.
Yeah, I know that column.
And then people just started sending me so many houses. We had such a stockpile, and people would send me this house and be like, oh my gosh, look at this house. And I'd be like, I know. And I would look on Zillow and it would have like 4 views. And I'm like, no one's ever going to appreciate this. And it'd be sitting in my inbox. And I'm like, I quite literally need a dumping ground to put these things
now
on.
Some of these, I mean, if you look at the Instagram analytics, it's like 875,000 people saw this old house. Like
so houses that would never be appreciated. And it feels so good that we can sort of share them with people. And Cheap Old Houses was just for fun. I never thought it would ever make money on its own. And now it's like much more of a business model than Circa is. So
well, that's what I mean. It's like the houses from Circa are so aspirational. And the houses from Cheap Old Houses feel like, oh, these are attainable. Like I can actually, like I'll go to Circa and daydream and I'll look at Cheap Old Houses and go, oh, this, you know, I'm sure a lot of people see themselves in the houses like, oh, this is just a little bit, you know, it's a little bit scuffed up, but it just needs some love. And it can like, you can see the story of it.
Right. It's like, yeah, right. It's like people who fall in love with troubled people because they want to save them. It's like the same thing. You know, I think that's what it is. You see how
I hope you didn't see that in me. I don't know.
You're like, you know, it not only like could I live there and it could be beautiful, but like it needs me and I'm going to help it. And then in some cases, like help the whole community. I mean, some of these towns, they're shrinking. People are leaving them. You know, to think that there could be good bones there that could bring people back in some cases are all some of these towns have going for them right now. If there isn't a huge job base and they're people are leaving. So,
but it is interesting that any kind of business, almost any kind of digital business that you start now is really a marketing business in the sense that everything just requires some sort of a knowledge or an understanding of like how to cut through all the noise. I mean, it's fine. Like, listen, if someone just wants to start a passion project and they're totally comfortable, they just love it so much and none of the other stuff matters. It doesn't have to matter, but just in terms of scaling up, which is generally the decision that, you know, like when people are in something for a while, they are often have to kind of make that decision. Do I want to keep this intimate in the way that it is? Or how do I scale it up while maintaining the intimacy and the personality of it, but still reaching more of an audience and becoming more of a marketing thing. And so I feel like most things online now are just friggin' marketing, and social media has both helped and fucked everything up at the same time, because social media, like, I feel like pulled people away from blogs and basically had to turn blogs into brands that have a social media presence. Mm-hmm. And now I feel like a lot of the social media companies algorithmically are really focusing more on user experience and not enough on the content creator experience to help content creators cut through the noise. And so, you know, everyone has kind of seen their numbers get hacked at the knees in terms of reach. And these are people whose businesses were kind of wrecked by social media, who took them away from the blogs. It's like, okay, guys, every time you make an algorithm change, it can really affect someone's business, like someone's personal business who relies on reaching people that agreed to follow them but aren't seeing the posts because your algorithm is deciding that it's not relevant to them. It's like, what the fuck? What are we, you know, like, and so that idea of marketing.
Did this just happen to you, Chris?
It's happened to everyone.
I literally feel like 2 everybody days ago recently, Instagram did something, because, I feel it.
It doesn't really affect my personal thing, but it affects like so many people I know whose businesses rely on an Instagram audience.
Well, and when you're talking about a farm to quote unquote table, like a meat delivery service or something, that's how the farm is sustaining, besides like the local community. You know, I mean, Elizabeth has done some recent interviews with some farmers who like ship meat across the country, and to your point, I mean, it's literally how they're sustaining themselves in the middle of Idaho, you know, or whatever.
Right. You can reach a bigger audience now, and you're not limited to your local community. I think one of the things is to not exist solely on a social media platform. I mean, we collect emails as well, like, because then you own your list and Instagram doesn't own it. And if Instagram decides that they want to do something, you have no way to communicate with your people. So I think you just have to like diversify your, honestly.
We could talk about the marketing side of stuff forever.
There is so much strategy that goes into anything like this. I think we are past the days where it's like, oh, you run an Instagram feed? Like, oh, that's so cute. You know, it's like, no, this is like, it's a content platform like a magazine is or a newspaper is. I mean, it's an editorial, it's a platform, and it takes a ton of strategy.
You're right. It's like everyone has their own little personal magazine. But just in terms of understanding some of the marketing side, what are some of the marketing questions that you ask as you're looking at something like Circa or Cheap Old Houses, or, you know, even for the bigger brands that you work with, what are some of the initial questions that people should be asking themselves if they have a passion project, you know, and they want to kind of take it to the next level?
It's finding your unique voice in it. I mean, that's what Ethan can say a lot more about this, because he actually does this for a living.
But I also think listening to your audience, like, what is your, so first you have to have your niche, and then you, and then what do these people want? You know, I think for Circa, the real estate agents want their houses lifted up. They don't want to be a dime a dozen in, you know, on Zillow or whatever platform. They want to be lifted up to a platform that makes them look good within a collection of other things that look good. And, you know, that's a consistent, I think for Cheap Old Houses, I mean, some of these realtors, for example, obviously the people love it, but the realtors, it's kind of insane to hear some of the stories behind the realtor side of it, because we've had, you know, we've posted some houses and like hundreds of people have called the realtors, and the agents on the other line in, like, you know, some small town, America, is like, what the hell is going on? Like, why are we getting all these phone calls? Like, what, you know, and they didn't know they were featured.
Yeah, like in some tiny town that like,
and the broker is always like, shut up. Like, I've been waiting for 30 years and in my whole career to like have the phone ring off the hook. Like it is now. So, I don't know what just happened, but you know, I think from the realtor's perspective, these are houses that never would have been seen before. And now they're able to get them, you know, make their client happy and, you know, sell the house and seen, you know, the community, it benefits the community as a whole too, because, you know, you're restoring that house.
Well, I feel like we picked a pretty easy field. Like, there are some fields that are harder to do this because they're more oversaturated. Like the old house real estate world was not oversaturated. It is now, but when we started, we're like, gee, we're going to make old houses cool. Like, we're the only people that are doing that. Like, most of the real estate sites that were focused on old houses were, you know, a little older looking, like they just, and this is, I'm not throwing shade at older people at all. I mean, there are like, there are a lot of people who do the wonderful thing of when they retire, it's always been their dream to buy an old house. And they're some of the people that like do the most amazing work on an old house because it's like been their lifelong dream. And we have so many people that have bought cheap old houses that are at that age and they're doing like some of my favorite projects. So I don't want to say that this is like just something that younger people do, but I do think we were the first people to position the world of old houses and restoration in a way that young people could understand. And I also think like, are the language that we use. It's, again, it's just finding your own voice. The language that we've always used on Circa. I mean, I come from a very academic background. I don't use big preservation words. You know, I think of it a little bit like wine. You know, if just because you don't know how to describe wine doesn't mean that you can't taste it and be like, I like that. And you might feel that you're sort of shut out of the world of like wine connoisseurs, but whatever, if you like it, you like it. And I think there's a magic people feel when they walk into old houses that you don't have to have a degree in architectural history to understand. I mean, I was a little kid growing up in one and I felt the magic of like the secret room. We had a secret room in my house that was like a little corridor connecting to the two parts of the house that were built at separate times. And I think that, you know, we wanted to tap into that magic and not exclude anyone. So our language has always been very celebratory, very positive, very just like familiar and friendly so as to not, you know, alienate or
and for us there's always away. Like that, I don't know, the visceral feeling of you're passing by an old house and you see it kind of, you know, as you're cruising by or whatever, and you know I remember as a young kid too, like, I wonder what's going on there, like I wonder, you know, you just have this like super curiosity and you know it's like falling down or whatever and you can't help but look. It's like this, you know,
like I think everyone, even people who wouldn't say they're preservationists or old house people, like have seen that fixer upper and feel that, like, you're curious about it. Like everyone has the story of that house in their town growing up, of that like creepy house that everybody wondered about, you know, that had all these stories connected to it.
And now we briefly pause to thank our sponsor for this segment of the ID10T podcast, Fight Camp. Fight Camp is an at-home interactive boxing training program. When I started fitness training about 15 years ago, boxing was an integral part of that because I wanted a full-body workout. I wanted to improve or get any hand-eye coordination. And I also wanted to have balance, learn better balance. And boxing training is amazing for all of those things. And now, especially now, it can be more difficult to go to gyms, for instance. So Fight Camp is the perfect solution if you're looking to take your fitness training to the next level or even to start at level one, because Fight Camp has over 400 workouts for all skill levels, from absolute beginners all the way up to seasoned fighters. It is the perfect high-intensity interval training, and it can be right in your living room. Fight Camp allows you to track your progress. You can also connect with the Fight Camp community on Facebook and enter challenges, share successes, and even access a leaderboard if you're up for some healthy competition. Fight Camp is free to test out. Just download the app. And when you're ready to buy, you're going to get world-class equipment, everything you need to start right away. The best freestanding punching bag, great boxing gloves, quick hand wraps. Now, Fight Camp offers flexible financing for as low as 0% APR, and right now is a limited time offer. You can try Fight Camp for 30 days with their money-back guarantee. Just go to joinfightcamp.com/Chris, C-H-R-I-S, my first name, in case you forgot. Try Fight Camp for 30 days. And if you don't love it, they will refund your money. That's joinfightcamp.com/Chris for incredible boxing fitness training. Thanks to Fight Camp for sponsoring this segment of the ID10T podcast, which we now return to. But how do you keep it? Because ultimately it is about your love of architecture and preserving these old houses. And when you turn your passion into a business, sometimes I feel like some of the business stuff, which is for some people, the less fun stuff, is like, well, but if you want to grow this thing, you got to kind of pay attention to some of that stuff. And so how are you, I guess it's very helpful that you both kind of have a very specific role within the organization so that, Elizabeth, I imagine you can still focus on as much of the creative stuff you want to, and Ethan, you can figure on as much as the creative marketing stuff and the business right. stuff that you want to. But how do you still maintain your passion for the stuff when the business stuff gets annoying and kind of gets in the way? It's like, I didn't really want to be managing a bunch of stuff. I just want to find old houses and tell people about old houses. How do you kind of keep the balance when you're scaling up your passion project?
It's hard. I mean, sometimes you have to put in the years of work, and then you have to be like, all right, I need to hire this out. Like, hopefully after you've put in years and years of work, you can, like, for instance, we sell products on Circa, like old house, cheerleader, rah-rah, like pennants and t-shirts and things like that. And I package them myself, and I'm not like, I don't love packaging products. Like, I like to design the products and to like wear them. And like, I love that creative part of it, but like the actual like fulfillment of the orders. And finally, just the other day, we're having someone else help us with that. So
have to hack at it or do it until you can get to that point where, you know, you can turn it over. Right. And you're going to take that little financial hit and then, but you're going to get that, all that life back. And then I think for the stuff on the positive side, like for us, it's the auctions, it's going to look at houses, it's continuing to dream, it's renovating our own house, it's doing the projects that, you know, we just like love being outside and like doing the projects in our house and tinkering and I don't know, I think that stuff and having our, and continually having another project, like that sounds ridiculous because we have a lot of projects going on in a way right now. But you know, I think we're not going to ever stop that kind of creative, like dabbling into other new fun things.
Yeah. My advice is like, find your voice, stick at it. Just like, don't stop because, you know, we know what we can turn on and what we'll get punished for turning off at this point. Like our audience, we can't disappoint our audience in certain ways. We know what they want to hear. We know what, like it used to be, you know, a few years ago, we couldn't take vacation. We would go on vacation and be like, oh my gosh, I'm not going to post on Instagram for a week and the whole thing's going to shut down. I'm going to have no business when we get back. Now I'm like, on vacation, see you in 2 weeks. And I'm like, nothing happens. It's really not the end of the world. I think but I wouldn't know that unless I had sort of gone through all the, you know, I think in a sense, you know, there are some businesses that very early on get swept up by an investor. And the people have less of an attachment to their business from the get-go. Like we are so scrappy and so like these things are so self-made that we know all the ins and outs of everything.
And we're like really ridiculously controlling in terms of, you know, we don't want to ever like really give it up. And it's probably to our demise, if you will. But, you know, it's like,
It's good in a way because I guess that we really
understand. It is good because if you turn it over to someone and they made a bad choice that wasn't in line with the kind of stuff, you would still eat shit for that even if you didn't make the choice. You know what I mean? Like you're still responsible for it. So it is still your child, right? And you still have the relationship to the audience. And so, no, I completely understand what you're talking about. It's just because you care about it. But also, you know, again, it's... Are you comfortable at all talking about sort of what the business model of Circa and Cheap Old Houses is? Just because I know that there's like people can subscribe to different email lists, which are great, by the way. There's a European one. There's a farmhouse. There's a farm one.
That's my favorite.
There's all sorts of really cool different subscriptions. So I know you sell a little bit of merch, and I know there are some email subscriptions. But like, what's the core business model of both of them?
So the core business model of Circa are the listings. So if you are marketing a historical home and you want to get it in front of an audience of people who are specifically looking for an old house, yeah, it's a flat fee to list it on Circa. So that's how Circa operates. Cheap Old Houses, we don't charge to post the houses on our website or Instagram feed, but we make money off of the newsletter subscriptions.
So what happens is on some of these, you know, posts, you have 800,000 people looking at a house, and then the sort of market kind of goes wildfire in terms of looking at this house, and it might become very competitive to get this house. So these newsletters offer, you know, a deeper dive every single week into 15 more properties specifically for farmhouses. And then they also give you a little bit more opportunity to be the person who's actually going to get it, because there's not millions of people looking at it.
There's less of like a pool of competition.
Got it. So, but there's no like referral fee or anything like sometimes.
No, we are not real estate agents. And I think in fact, we've looked into becoming them before and it's, you know,
we've definitely toyed with some different business options as to how this could work.
I really like just like presenting the house and the marketing side of it. And I don't know if I want to do the
real estate agent
side of it. And I think it would change. It would bring up conflicts with, like, I'm free to do so much now and kind of enjoy that freedom.
Well, so that's a really great point that you just made, because that comes from a place of you knowing what you want to do and how you want to live your life and the kind of balance you want to have, rather than just approaching it business first. Like, oh, I'm going to take a swing at something where I might make more money, but I would sacrifice freedom, flexibility, you know, quiet corners of my life because I'd be all in on this other thing. So that's a really profound kind of thing to understand, to know that you don't, that's just not, that brings up a whole bunch of other responsibilities and challenges that you're not interested in.
Trust me, I fight for some of the stuff, Chris, but like, you know, it's like,
I'm probably the one who's
these
always
are her
like,
babies.
But our family and our time, and like, we can't, like, cause I think I'm like, just like by nature, a pretty private person. So I don't like a lot of invasion into my life. So I'm always like trying to just be like, no, 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 no. And say no a lot. But Ethan throws a lot of,
but that's a good balance. That's a good balance that you guys have. You know, my mom's been a realtor for 35 years or something like that. And I think the other thing that the HGTV generation has sort of brought is, you know, it's soup's easy to just flip a house. You could just flip a house. And for a while, I'll even get caught up and go, Mom, should I flip a house? And she'll go, it's like gambling.
You know, honestly though, I swear, I don't think it's so much like gambling. I don't know. Like, I don't know. Maybe. And I'm still naive to such a degree though. That's the problem. Like I'm like, oh, it needs everything. Okay. You know, and I'm like, okay. And I start to do the number. I'm like, okay, plumbing for the whole house would cost. Okay. What does that cost? 10, 15, 20,000. Then da, da, da. And you just kind of go through all the things and I'm like, okay, like, even if you buy the house for $50,000 and you put $100,000, $200,000 in, you're like, okay. And the market says $200,000, $250,000 or whatever the market is in that area. I still am that naive. And
I think it's sometimes good to be naive in things in life. Like, I think that honestly, again, like we work so hard at this. And I honestly think if anyone had said like, it's going to be this much work, I would have been like, okay, no, I'll just stick with my desk job. And like, that's good.
And you always say to me, you're always like, if you go into an investment property thinking you're going to get your investment out, like you're not going into it's the right reasons too.
Well, if you're going into it for as an investment property, that's different. But I think a lot of the people, like my hope for the people who follow our feeds, and I think most old house people will tell you this, is like, you're never going to make your money back over the course of the 40 years that you live in this house and work on it and put your blood, sweat, and tears into it and do some things yourself and hire some things out. Like, you're never going to get that back. But what you are going to get back are like 40 years of like learning and the beauty of the house and having restored a piece of history
and
like,
in it
and when you think of it as just like if you're thinking of it as just the bottom line, then like maybe it's not the
best
thing.
Go buy a condo.
Yeah. And when people like tell, like, look at it that way, well, isn't it a ton of work and isn't it going to cost a lot of money? Like, I think they're sort of missing the point a little bit.
And also you don't have to own a house for 40 years. And I think that puts some people off too, when they hear like 40 year loan, they go, oh my God, I'm paying this for 40 years. Maybe, but you also at some point could sell that house and you could get another house or hang on to it and rent it out and have it as an income property. It's like, just because you're getting a loan for 40 years doesn't mean that you have to live in that house for 40 years, or even that you're committed to it for 40 years. You can sell it. But it is good if you love it. It is good if you love what you're doing. And even with flipping though, it's just like, okay, you know, you want to make sure that it's affordable and that the renovations can keep you underneath what the median value is in that area. And also like that you're prepared in case the house needs 10 times more. I always feel like it's always 2 or 3 times more expensive than you think it's going to be and 2 or 3 times longer than you think it's going to take.
Yeah.
And you really have to be comfortable knowing that a 30% might go sideways. And as long as you accept that, and know like, well, you'll get through it, then it's fine. But if you go in thinking it's going to be super easy, I don't want to put people off it, but I just do want them to understand like, But there is a, you know, there is a little bit of a curve to it. You know, there is, they're always gonna, I mean, in restoring,
you have to be a little crazy too, to even take it on first place, as your mom said, because she's like, I don't know. You know, it's like, but, and then just to even do the thing, you know, it's just,
yeah. Like I know we have friends who like, don't totally understand what we're doing. And like are sort of like, well, why would you, you know, and I'm like, you know, you shouldn't buy this. Like, this is not, but if you are the kind of person that feels this like drive and desire to do this, then, you know, don't let all the people who tell you you're crazy stop you, because you'll figure it out. Like there's, it's, well, people do it.
Some people just don't, and there's nothing, there's no right or wrong answer. Some people just see a house as a place to shower and sleep, and they just want it to be as simple as possible. They want to come in, have everything open, modern, simple, no, you know, and that's fine. That's totally fine for them. But if you really want, like, if you really want a living, breathing organism that is, you know, a place that's going to hold the story of your life and be a part of your family and be an expression of who you are, I enjoy that journey and I recommend it to people, but you know, it's not necessarily for everybody.
I agree. And I don't think it's good for the houses either to be taken over by someone who isn't totally into it. I think that you have to be in, you know, I don't think that the cheap old houses audience represents the majority of America by any sense. It's a very loud minority and excited minority, but we're a special breed. And I'm glad because I don't want to be competing with everybody for these.
It's such a, and I know that there is a bit of a trend, like in, you definitely hit on something that, you know, it's going back to the question about like, well, you know, when you're from a marketing standpoint, you know, it's sort of asking like, well, what else out there? Here's this need that we think exists. What else out there? What else is out there that's answering these questions? And it's like, oh, not really much, or not much in the way that I would do it. Like it's there, but it's not my point of view, or I have a spin on this that I think is really different. But again, you know, even just a couple simple questions for people to ask themselves to help cut through the noise. Cause that's, you know, when people say, they ask me about starting podcasts or they ask me about starting stand-up or whatever, and they go, yeah, but there's so many comedians, there's so many, you know, like podcasts, how do I cut through the noise? And it's like, well, you just be the most you are. But at a certain point, some marketing needs to kick in. And so what are those first couple of core questions?
Well, what is it that you, if you could spend all your time 24 hours a day doing, like, would you be happy doing it? It really is finding your voice, and it's putting the time in to be able to find your voice. And I think to some extent, like, you kind of have to be good at it. I think there may be some people who don't have good timing that could eventually learn to become comedians. But I think right. In a sense, there are certain attributes that make a good comedian, right? Like, and if you don't have it, it's going to be harder for you probably in the long run. So to have a sense also of your strengths and weaknesses, and have people always told you that you're funny and you always have good timing, and like what are those things, you know, are you...
I think also what platform is going to be the best for the thing that you're doing. So, I mean, I find it crazy that NBA students are learning about social media and like podcasting and like all the things that, you know, we are doing, and they're putting that into their business models. And like, what is the platform that's going to, you know, for us, it was Instagram, and we don't really want to be on Facebook, and we don't really want to be on, I don't know, like Twitter. It would never work on Snapchat
Twitter.
Blanking on the new one, Twitter, sure. What?
TikTok.
Exactly. I was thinking of TikTok. I'm like, you know, how do you make old houses dance on, you know, Twitter?
Well, yeah, you don't have to be on every platform. You just have to find the one that works for you, build your audience on it. And then I do believe that you need to expand a little bit away from it, because social media moves so quickly that,
and you have, and I think at the end, you have to have like a monetization sort of question. Like, what, you know, obviously everyone has ideals, but like, how do you make this work for you so it can actually become a business?
And it has to fit into your lifestyle. I think that you couldn't, you know, for a while I was I've always wanted to be able to do like more like YouTube house tours, but you know, I work from home. I have a 5-year-old. We're in a pandemic. There's no school. Like, that is very unrealistic for me to do. I mean, I'm married to someone who has a video agency and like, I still can't make that happen. And I think you just have to be like, look, is this like, I wouldn't be able to sustain that. So, but Instagram, like I can find real estate listings. I can put them up. Like
put
it has to
random
fit into
times.
Your life.
Totally. Yeah. And she's always fought for that. I don't even know how she's fought, but I fought for the videos for a while and she's like,
like I used to do a lot more like lectures and I was a oh, yeah. licensed New York City tour guide. And I would give like tours and, you know,
but
it
like
just
the time to go to do prep. Walking tours and the prep and the, you know, to get tips, you know, it's sort of like, oof, that business model doesn't, how do you convert that?
Also to realize that like if your first business doesn't work, like try again, you know, like we've started so many things and you just kind of throw darts and see what sticks and what people respond to.
Yeah, but ultimately you knew exactly what it was that you wanted to do in terms of, you know, I want balance. I want to work from home. I want to be able to be with my family. I want something that I don't have to answer to someone else. Like you had a, like separate from the specific passion, you had some global ideas that you were very certain about, which helped inform how you were going to express that passion. And I think those are the important questions for people to ask. It's like, not just what do I want to do, but what kind of life do I want to lead while doing it? How do I want this to fit into my life rather than being dragged around by this idea where you don't really have any control over your own life anymore?
She has a special like way to like know these things, and like my left arm will hurt and I'll think my right arm actually hurts, and like, and she's like, no, it's your left arm. And I'm like, how do you know this about my left arm? And she's good about this kind of stuff. I'm a little more, I don't know.
Ethan started like 4 businesses by 10 o'clock every morning. And then he has to take a nap because he's like so, he's spent.
Starting businesses is really fun. Starting things is great. But I find that the real friggin' skill set is maintaining, because absolutely. The maintenance is the unsexy part. It's like, that's the daily grind of like, now you're with this idea every day. You've lost that honeymoon period with it. And you still have to keep it going and maintain it, you know?
Well, for example, I have cheap old trucks as an Instagram. I don't know if you follow, but there's nothing to follow is the problem, because I haven't maintained it. And, right. And I'm like dying to be doing it on a daily basis. But, you know, so much of life is calling me in so many different ways. And it's like the most fun thing that I have in my life. And like, having my old truck and being able to mess with it. I mean, I was just in the garage the other day, you know, getting some stuff done with it with a buddy. Like, just those are the things that I really want to be doing. And, you know.
But it's also okay to not love it every day. I feel like we might sound a little bit like, we love what we do and we love it every day and it's so great and we're so inspired to get up and work every day. No, there are definitely days when I'm like, you know, nothing really exciting is happening with it. Instagram changed their algorithm and we have no likes. And I'm like, nah, this is kind of, you know, or the real estate market, it's really blah that day and there's nothing good out there and I'm not able to find content. And there are definitely days that it doesn't feel that great. And you know what? You do it anyway. You just do it and it's not the most exciting day. And then you just keep going. And then a few weeks later, something will happen or you'll get an opportunity. And I think that I think this might be a little bit getting older, but I think younger generations especially are very much like, if I'm not feeling 100% connected to my business, then it must be wrong. And, you know, there will be days when it just, it's like, you just don't feel like doing it, you know, and there,
yeah,
and you kind of
like
wish
you have know. A relationship with it. And not every day is going to be like the most magical day. You know, it's like some days are, you know, like with your work, it's like, some days you just get through them and then tomorrow it could be a great day. And the next day you're tired. And the next day there's a fire that you have to put out, you know, with the business. It's like, it's just sort of the ebb and flow of it. You know, you got to accept that. By the way, Ethan, I got to pitch you an idea. Since you have a video marketing agency, why not just do your cheap old truck thing as like, kind of like a video podcast where your buddy comes over, you work on your truck a little bit. You guys kind of like dick around a little bit, just have some small talk. And then it's like videos of like the actual process of restoring trucks, because to me, and I'm not like a big car guy, but I do love really interesting cars. But to me, it feels like that essential quality of automotive is kind of watching something get restored.
Yep.
You know, and maybe there's some, just a pitch, maybe there's something in there. Maybe those are some of the videos.
The ideas, Chris, are like
that would be so fun though.
I love it. And trust me, it's there. It's all there. That's the problem in like, how do we like, we have to also keep some of our stuff.
Yeah. Like, you know, those people who just don't have like many interests in life and they just kind of like kick back with a beer all weekend and don't do much. Like that is not us. We have so many ideas and we're just like, we need a million like people that fulfill them and do them for us. Cause we're just, I don't know.
Yeah. You have to pick and choose. Like at some point, someone must have approached you about doing a Cheap Old Houses TV show. Like there must be a Cheap Old Houses TV show in development somewhere.
We've definitely been approached.
And it's just not, is it just feel like, it's just an extra thing we don't really want to sink our energy into?
You know, I'm not a person that has ever been like, I need a TV show, I want to be famous. In fact, probably quite the opposite. I will only do a TV show if it's like the right, if it's what Cheap Old Houses is about, and it really represents it well. So I'm totally open to doing it. And I'm just such an idealist. Like I just would want to make it sort of the perfect thing. So
well, even if you're not on it, even if you don't want to be on camera, it could be like those ones, like the ones where people, you know, pick from three homes. There's no host really. It's all sort of told through the story of the couple or the person who's buying the house, you know? If you didn't want to be on camera, but it just,
I mean, being on camera is kind of fun. I actually went to college originally for theater. I kind of like it. I think
giving up control as to someone else telling the story, I think would be impossible for Elizabeth too. So.
This is true.
No, I totally hear you. And that's great. I mean, it feels like there could be a platform jump and it just feels like it could be a TV show because my frustration with a lot of the renovation shows is that they always, I mean, I love when shows are really about restoration and there's not a lot of shows that are about specifically restoration.
Yep.
And the revitalization of, and there are a few, there's, you know, like, there's a couple on DIY. They're mainly DIY shows, but, or restored by
Brett Waterman,
yeah. Nicole Curtis
is great. You know, Main Cabin Masters, they're restoration, but just in terms of like the actual, just specifically focusing on these inexpensive old houses and making it attainable. I'm not seeing anything like that in the landscape right now. And so I don't know. Listen, I'm saying if you did it, I would watch. I'm really pushing you to try to do this because it's a show I want to see.
Well, that's awesome to hear. It's a show I would watch too. So for all the networks out there listening, we'd be totally down for it. And it's definitely something we've considered before for sure.
Good. Well, it's been really enjoyable talking to you both. And I think it's just such a great lesson in, yes, it's great to follow your passion, but also have somewhat of a plan. You don't have to know everything up top. Be open to learning, be open to doing everything yourself. But also just really that core idea of what kind of life do you want to lead when you get there? Like, how do you want, and I think that's actually probably the most important question because if something really blows up and takes off, it is kind of a best case, worst case scenario. It's like, oh, good news. Also, bad news because you're stuck with it now, so you better love it. You better love what you do.
Right. Totally. And honestly, making money from it might make you love it more. So you might, if you didn't, you might learn to like love that. But yeah, for sure.
Is there anything else that you want to promote or plug, you know, that in the Circle Old House ecosystem that's going on?
Well, if you don't already follow us at Cheap Old Houses and Circa Houses on Instagram and Facebook. And subscribe to one of our newsletters. We have newsletters for cheap-ish old houses. Those are houses for sale for under $250,000 that focuses a little bit on more expensive parts of the country where you're not going to find anything for under $100,000. We have Cheap Old Houses Abroad, which focuses on Europe and Canada. And we have Cheap Old Farmhouses, which is houses under $150,000 on 3 or more acres. And I get very excited when I talk about that one because it's my favorite. And I love researching the houses every week for that one. So...
Yeah, that's great. I mean,
and you can do that at cheapoldhouses.com is where you can subscribe.
I hope to pick up cheap old trucks someday. So, you know, you can follow it.
You might get around to it. Like you, if, you know, if, and it could just be one of those things that's like, oh, you know, I had this idea. It was just kind of noodling around in my head for a while. And then one day I went out to the garage and it all just clicked. Like, but yep. Just knowing that it's out there.
That tends to be how things happen, I think.
Yep.
You sort of wake up one day and it just makes sense. Like we've been saying for so long, we want to do products and we just never done it. And then one day it just made sense to do it.
I have dreams for shows. You have to restore a truck and build the truck before you go on the Rubicon Trail. And it's got to get through the Rubicon Trail and
the cheap old truck.
Cheap old truck, you know.
Well, that's a great idea. Yeah. Yeah. You have to like put it to the test. It's like you restore it and then you got to put it to the test.
Exactly. Exactly. So who knows? Yes. Well, Chris, you got to come with me on this journey of cheap old trucks too. So
I would love to. I mean, anything y'all ever. I'll do anything you guys want. You know, like I love preservation. I sort of feel like not only is it better to kind of better for the environment to sort of preserve what's already there, but also like, you know, if something has survived for a 100, 200 years, which is old in America, it's not old in most other parts of the world, but it's old in America, you know, it's like, hey, it's really hung in there. Like, let's give it a fighting shot to let it create a whole new series of stories for people and not just, you know, knock shit down and put up glass boxes that I think look ridiculous now, but are certainly going to look ridiculous in 10 years. I mean, like if in the 70s, if they knocked everything down and put up those old clamshell houses on the pedestal that were like super 70s, but then those were everywhere. It was like 5 years later, be like, what the fuck is this? You know, like it's.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, I mean, you know, I mean, like, well, we used to live in Brooklyn and like everybody loves the brownstone neighborhoods. And there was something called urban renewal in the 60s where they bulldozed them all and put up like, you know, towers in the park where they thought that was going to be cleaner and more. And, you know, yeah, we definitely make mistakes and we learn from them.
And in Brooklyn, we had, you know, a guy that was the rent is too damn high. You know, we have a housing crisis, but there's towns and across America that need people.
Right.
Yeah.
You know, so it's like, and talk, there's the environmental component. There's the
community revitalization. The mental health component. There's the feeling
the financial freedom component. I mean, to us, this is no-brainer.
I guarantee you there are people, even if who either are listening to this podcast or even before this episode of the podcast, just looking at the feed, that have been feeling weird, stuck, out of place or whatever, living in a dense city. And then we'll just see a house on your feed and go, "What? I don't need to live in this city anymore. I can go to this place and I can do everything that I need to do there and simplify and have a much, much more room and a much better community and a nicer story to tell and a more, you know." And so I feel like you do offer people the promise of that, of like a better life.
And the truth is, the day you leave one of these communities that you feel will be missing out on you, you'll leave and nothing will really change, right? Like we left New York City and we left for a suburb or a small town outside of New York City.
It's a small town, not
small
a
town,
suburb.
Sorry. And nothing changed. New York did not implode. We did not implode. It was a scary decision because we had been there for so many years, but New York operates well, perfect without us.
Yes. Well, yeah, it is really interesting though. I mean, and I think COVID has really just brought this out so much, this feeling of like escapism. You know, you're in your cubicle, you're pushing papers around, you're not using your hands, and you see this thing that like, you can use your hands, you can, you know, we see pixels. We don't get that sense of satisfaction that you get from like completing a project from start to right. finish with your hands. And so
I'm not into fear mongering, but this winter, not in a cheap old house, you know, with a little bit of land or whatever, you know, stuck in your city apartment, kind of scares me. I'm not into fear mongering though.
Yeah, it's you know, I think a lot of people have made the leap, but you know, where my parents live is 4 hours north of the city and was always too far for really city people to move to. And real estate listings are staying on the market a day up there now. They're flying off the market. I think people are like people are leaving cities, right? And I don't mean to. We love Brooklyn. I love New York City. Yeah. I love so much about it. But let's be honest, it's insanely expensive and unrealistic for most people. Yeah. And there needs to be some sort of reckoning here.
Well, and also, I think people just assumed, because there wasn't really a motivating factor to shake the system loose of like, okay, if I want this, you know, whatever this type of job, whatever this kind of random job that I'm into, I need to be in this place and I have to go through this system and I have to work in these kinds of offices. And now this is kind of make people go, and not for every profession, but for a lot of them, like, oh, wait a minute. I never really thought about it, but maybe I don't, you know, when everyone at the same time is doing that, it really does sort of shake the system loose a little bit and, you know, make people go like, oh, I could live in Congers, New York and still do what I do. Maybe go into the city every once in a while, but, you know, have room to breathe. Or, you know, but again, some professions, yes, you need to be in the sort of center and that's fine. But I'm saying not all of them now we're realizing.
Yep. Yeah. I almost feel like it's like the creatives that were are a lot of the, you know, pushed out communities in a way.
And the creative industries are the last ones that are going to come back.
And they're also the ones that kind of focus on our feed and they like really understand our feed because they're the ones that are dreamers and always thinking of something new.
Well,
and
I know so many actors, performers, comedians who are like, oh, well, I can do all my auditions via my phone and email them. Most things don't shoot in Los Angeles anyway. Why am I, you know, my wife and I happen to like it here, so we're staying, but a lot of people I know are like, no, I got a place in Utah or I got a place in Idaho and I'm just going to go there. And like, you know, as long as I'm close to an airport, then it doesn't really, I'd probably end up shooting in Vancouver anyway. So like,
right.
What's the point? So I hope the business continues to grow in a way that is satisfying and manageable and healthy for you both. And, you know, I really appreciate what you do. And you just have, Elizabeth, you just have such an amazing eye. Like every damn house on Circle Old Houses, like, oh, that's stunning. Oh my God, that's everything has like a really special quality. And that comes from you because you are seeing that, you're aggregating that. And and I really appreciate it, and I will continue to recommend your site to people. You know, as long as you have it.
Well, you are wonderful, and thank you for seeing the beauty in this. It's nice to talk to, I guess, like a kindred spirit, someone who just innately understands it and gets it. So
well, it's awesome being on the show.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. Yeah. Thank you, Chris. Have a great rest.
Good to see you both. Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye. Thanks.
ID10T scanning complete. Enjoy your burrito.